In God's Path, The Arab Conquests and the Creation of an Islamic Empire. Written by Robert G. Hoyland. To the great despair of historians, men fail to change their vocabulary every time they change their customs. Mark Bloch, The Historian's Craft. Translator Peter Putman, Manchester, 1954, page 28. Introduction. There is an old Middle East legend that tells of a band of Christian youths fleeing the persecution of a pagan Roman emperor in the mid-3rd century AD. They leave their native city behind and seek refuge in a cave, where they soon fall asleep. When they go out on what they assume to be the following day, they are astonished to hear church bells ringing out across the streets below and to see crosses on all the high buildings. Unbeknown to them, God had spared them from witnessing the cruel ravages of heathenism by putting them to sleep for 2 centuries, and so the youths passed overnight from a pagan world to a Christian one. One experiences much the same feeling when one studies the 7th century Middle East. Histories of the region up until AD 630 present an image of a largely Christian land, where Christ's word is fast gaining ground even in the deserts of Africa, the Persian Empire, and as far away as China. But when one turns to Muslim accounts to read about the post-630 world, then it appears that the Prophet Muhammad's preaching was carried at breakneck speed from its birthplace in West Arabia across the whole Middle East by Arab soldiers, who then established unified rule over all the lands of the former Persian Empire and in all the southern and eastern provinces of the Byzantine Empire in only a few short years. The Arabs are everywhere victorious. Non-Arabs everywhere submit, convert, or are killed, and Islamic government is everywhere imposed. Or at least, this is the picture that 9th century Muslim historians painted, and it is one that has been widely accepted ever since. The problem with this narrative is not so much that it is wrong, but that, like all histories told from the standpoint of the victors, it is idealizing and one-sided. The role of God and Islam is played up, and the role of non-Muslims is mostly ignored. It is the aim of this book to try to give a more rounded account of this undeniably world-changing phenomenon. The main strategy for achieving this is a simple one. I will give precedence to 7th and 8th century texts and documents over later ones. Our earliest extant Muslim sources date from the 9th century, and even though their authors were using earlier materials, they inevitably shaped them in the light of their own world. This is, of course, always so, but the problem is magnified in this case because the political and religious landscape of the 9th century Middle East was so dramatically different from that of the 7th century. It may seem very odd to an outsider to this field why this strategy of privileging earlier sources over later ones would not have been used before. Is it not just standard practice for modern historians? The problem is that the early sources are overwhelmingly of Christian provenance and in languages other than Arabic, and so they fall outside the usual purview of Islamic historians, and it is also assumed that they will be either prejudiced or ill-informed. Christian authors inevitably had their own preconceptions and biases, but the Arab conquests did affect them concretely and directly, and so there is very good reason to refer to their works to write about this subject. Moreover, those living in the decades shortly after the conquests still understood the late antique world in which these events had occurred, and so can help us to understand what these events meant in their own time, as opposed to what they meant to the inhabitants of the 9th century Islamic world. But I do not want simply to champion non-Muslim sources over Muslim sources. Indeed, it is my argument that the division is a false one. Muslims and non-Muslims inhabited the same world, interacted with one another, and even read one another's writings. In this book, the distinction I make is simply between earlier and later sources, and I favor the former over the latter, irrespective of the religious affiliation of their authors. This strategy allows me to put back a number of elements missing from the traditional narrative. The first is process. The word most associated with the Arab conquests by Western scholars is speed. The speed of the Arab expansion is staggering, says one. Another speaks of its near miraculous speed, like a human tsunami speeding outwards. This reflects the assumption that the Arab conquests were over and done with in a few short years. For example, a famous modern medievalist sums up the situation with this sentence. The Muslim Arab armies conquered half of one empire, that of East Rome, and all of another, Sasanian Persia, and most of this process was completed in 6 years, 636 to 642. This massive compression of the duration of the conquests means that the process by which they were achieved is lost. The Arabs' victories were certainly stunning, and their progress was much faster than that of settled powers like the Romans, but it is comparable with armies comprising a high proportion of nomads. The Mongols actually covered a larger area in just 70 years. To help make clear the varied pace and extended duration of the conquests, I have decided to proceed chronologically and to take the narrative up to the 740s, which is when the Arab conquest juggernaut finally runs out of steam. As in all human ventures, things did not always go to plan. The Arabs suffered some reverses and had to come to an accommodation with some peoples, but none of this diminishes the impressive scale of their overall achievement. The second element that needs to be put back is the voices of the vanquished and of the non-Muslim conquerors. The 9th century historians wanted to create a distinctively Arab-Muslim history, which meant downplaying the role of non-Arabs and non-Muslims and placing God, Muhammad, and the Muslims center stage. President Barack Obama, when asked whether he thought the American people had a special mission, diplomatically replied that every people likes to think that it is special. And it is the specialness of their people that these 9th century Muslim historians were trying to portray. Like the Christian historian Eusebius before them, they wanted to record the implementation of God's plan for his chosen people. Just as Eusebius of Caesarea, died 339, began his ecclesiastical history with Christ, so Muslim historians made a strong distinction between profane time, when barbarity, jahl, prevailed, and sacred time, when Muhammad founded his community at Medina. This act is linked with the initiation of raiding by Muhammad and later full-scale conquest, which were approved by God, so these historians say, as a means of propagating Islamic rule across the world. It is a sign of God's love for us and satisfaction with our faith, as one Muslim general explained to a Christian monk, that he has given us dominion over all religions and all peoples. But this is an idealized, simplified, and homogenized picture, whereas the reality was complex and variegated. Wars are messy affairs. The composition of the opposing sides and the reasons for which they are fighting are often diverse and shifting. However, those who wage the wars and those who document them have a strong interest in portraying the situation as black and white. Believers against infidels, good against evil, justice and freedom against tyranny and oppression. Third, I will emphasize the prehistory of the Arab conquests. Muslim sources give the impression that Muhammad and his companions invented the world anew. Rather, they refashioned the world that they found. To understand this, however, one needs to be familiar with the culture of the Middle Eastern lands that the Arabs appropriated. Here, non-Muslim sources are particularly useful, for they can inform us about the period before the Arab conquests, commonly now referred to as Late Antiquity, in acknowledgement of the fact that some elements of the ancient world still endured. This means that we can work forward from this time and see how events unfolded and changes occurred from the 6th to the 8th century. If, however, we follow the usual practice of Islamic historians and work backward from the 9th century sources, we hit a wall with the time of Muhammad and will end up concluding with medieval Muslim authors that Islamic civilization flows directly from pre-Islamic West Arabia. Finally, I will try to broaden the horizons of the narrative rather than focus narrowly on Muhammad's movements in West Arabia and the activities of his successors. Arab tribesmen had been serving in the armies of Byzantium and Persia in large numbers in the 5th and the 6th centuries, and some powerful clans had managed to establish petty states on the margins of these empires. A new world power, a Turkic confederation, had seized control of vast swaths of the lands between Persia and China in the late 6th century and was launching attacks against the Persians. The 1,500-year-old civilization of Yemen had collapsed in the mid-6th century, and many of the ancient settlements of Northwest and East Arabia were shrinking. And the two superpowers of the region, Byzantium and Persia, engaged in all-out war for more than two decades in the early 7th century. Yet even experts narrow their vision to concentrate wholly on Muhammad's West Arabia and consider it sufficient simply to say that the Arab conquests happened and succeeded because of the religious zeal of the Muslims, without any reference at all to broader socio-economic factors. I do not want to belittle the role of religion, but rather to expand its remit. Religion is integral to the conquests and the evolution of an Islamic empire, but religion is not just piety and devotion, especially not in the 7th century. It is as much about power and identity as spiritual yearnings and righteous behavior. To reduce this later Islamicizing perspective, I will speak of Arab conquests rather than Islamic conquests. Both terms are to some degree inaccurate, since the conquerors were neither all Arabs nor all Muslims, and the meaning of both terms was, in any case, evolving in the immediate aftermath of the conquests. Nevertheless, contemporary observers mostly referred to the conquerors in ethnic rather than religious terms, and even if some of the conquerors were not Arabs, their descendants often came to think of themselves as such, and so it seems preferable to use the term Arab, while bearing in mind that we are not talking about a nationalist endeavor nor an immutable racial category. Islamicists would say that religion plays a greater role in the object of their study, but that is a dubious claim. When the Vandal king Gaiseric was asked one day by his ship's captain whither he should sail, he replied, "Against those with whom God is angry, of course, and this accords well with the spirit of the conquerors treated in this book." Furthermore, if we use the term Islamic conquests, we cannot distinguish between the many different conquests achieved over the centuries by many Muslim groups, Iranians, Turks, Kurds, Berbers, etc. This causes much confusion among students, and among quite a few experts, too, for it tends to be assumed that the Arabs conquered most or all of the lands that are majority Muslim today, whereas a large proportion of them were actually conquered much later by local Muslim dynasties of non-Arab origin, or were Islamized slowly by traders, missionaries, and wandering ascetics. In general, this book tries to emphasize complexity and ambiguity, and to give voice to groups that are not normally heard. Historians writing at a considerable remove from the events they are describing tend to simplify, schematize, telescope, and idealize their narratives. Since our modern accounts of the Arab conquests have relied upon 9th century writers for this 7th century phenomenon, they have tended to perpetuate and intensify these tendencies, stressing the miraculous speed and success of the conquests and the religiosity of the conquerors. My aim is to reintegrate these conquests and their impact into the fabric of human history, against the prevailing trend to see them as utterly exceptional, and I hope thereby to make them more explicable according to the usual norms of human behavior. The achievements of the Arab conquerors were immense, but they can be properly appreciated only if we also take account of the difficulties and reverses that they had to overcome. A note on Arabic. Names in Arabic are usually given in the form X ibn X, X son of X, sometimes followed by an epithet, nisba, that further specifies a person's identity, usually the person's tribe, profession, or place of origin. Chapter 1. The Setting. In an oft-quoted passage, the Byzantine historian Theophylact Simocatta refers to the empires of Byzantium and Persia as the two eyes of the world, the divinely ordained realms responsible for maintaining order and civilization amid a sea of inferior, untrustworthy barbarians. Of the Saracen tribe, for example, he writes that they were most unreliable and fickle, their mind is not steadfast, and their judgment is not grounded in prudence. They needed to be kept in check so that justice and harmony could reign, but they were not a serious problem, for the two empires would always prevail. And yet, this comfortable world order, which had endured so long, was suddenly turned upside down by the Arab conquerors not long after Theophylact had finished his work sometime in the 620s. In the end, he had no successor. The genre of secular history, going back more than 1,000 years to Thucydides, came to an abrupt end, as though in sympathy with the way of life that it had so well described, and now was no more. This, and a number of other seemingly dramatic changes, in particular the rise of the new religion of Islam, have led many scholars to see the Arab conquests as the last nail in the coffin of the classical world, and as the herald of a medieval society. This was the view of the Belgian scholar Henri Pirenne, who let the Western, Germanic, barbarians off the hook, arguing against the English historian Edward Gibbon that they were responsible for extending the life of the Roman Empire and not for destroying it. The 5th and 6th centuries could now be rehabilitated and rebranded as an age when classical values remained in vogue, reshaped by Christianity and the barbarian customs of the likes of the Franks, Goths, and Lombards, but certainly not effaced. Accordingly, the somber epithet of Dark Ages could now be replaced by the cheery sobriquet of Late Antiquity. However, the Eastern Arab barbarians became Pirenne's bête noire. The Arab capture of North Africa and the Levant made the Mediterranean into a barrier rather than a conduit, so Pirenne maintained, and thus southern Europe was cut off from the East, causing it to stagnate. On the plus side, however, the Arabs kept Byzantium busy, and this allowed new forms of statehood to blossom in northern Europe, culminating in the Carolingian Empire. Islamic historians have also tended to see the Arab conquests as a turning point, though from their perspective it is the beginning of the new and not the end of the old. In this, they are governed by medieval Muslim sources, which reset the clock and made the establishment of the Prophet Muhammad's polity and the launch of the Arab conquests the starting point for Islamic history. These sources, mostly composed by writers living in Iraq in the 9th and 10th centuries, have no acquaintance or sympathy with the late antique world that the Arabs overran, and pay little heed to it in their writings, thus reinforcing the sense that when one travels from the pre-conquest Middle East of Theophylact Simocatta and enters the post-conquest world of the first Muslim rulers, one is crossing a watershed, exchanging one society for a totally different one. This is, of course, merely an illusion of the sources, but unfortunately it is made concrete by the fact that two different sets of modern historians, late Romanists and early Islamicists, with very different agendas, linguistic skills, and suppositions, work either side of the divide. It is the aim of this book to try to smooth out this artificial rupture, to focus on continuities as well as changes, on processes as well as events. This can only be achieved by first understanding what went before, and this is the subject of the rest of this chapter, for, as with all world-changing phenomena, there was a long build-up to the event, a lengthy period in which key transformations took place in the Middle East that made the conquests both possible and likely. The Superpower Confrontation. To understand the Arab conquests, we need to go back all the way to the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD, when the Roman Empire made a great push to the east. This began with Emperor Trajan's war of AD 106 against Persia, and was followed up by numerous expeditions eastward by high-ranking military men and emperors. One by one, they annexed the lands of the once independent dynasties of Petra, Palmyra, and Edessa, which brought Rome into direct contact with the pastoralist tribes that these dynasts had formerly managed on her behalf. Under Emperor Septimius Severus, 193-211, two extra legions were created for service in the east, meaning that 8 legions were now stationed in the zone that stretched from the new province of Mesopotamia, in modern southeast Turkey and northwest Iraq, southward to Arabia. It looked as though Rome would gradually come to dominate the whole of the Middle East. However, the game changed in 224, when the energetic Sasanian dynasty took over the Persian Empire, which comprised Iraq and Greater Iran, for it pursued a more centralizing and expansionist policy than its predecessors. The Sasanians launched a series of devastating attacks upon Rome's eastern flank in the mid-3rd century, achieving numerous victories and even managing to capture the Roman emperor himself. Only the intervention of the prefect of Palmyra, who rallied an army of townsmen and tribesmen, saved Rome from Persia's seemingly unstoppable onslaught. Thereafter, the two empires came to a grudging acceptance of one another, eyeing each other warily across the Syrian desert, mostly respecting each other's sovereignty except for occasional skirmishes and forays to extract tribute and captives, and to make a show of strength for audiences back home. Though the western portion of the Roman Empire suffered instability and loss of territory during the 4th and 5th centuries, the eastern part continued to flourish, now based at a new capital, Constantinople, on the site of the ancient Greek city of Byzantium, which is the name that modern scholars use when referring explicitly to the Christian East Roman Empire, though its own citizens kept thinking of themselves as Romans. The geopolitical situation described earlier, the empires of Byzantium and Persia in a sort of Cold War standoff, remained relatively stable through the 4th and 5th centuries, but the 6th century witnessed a sharp escalation in hostilities. Major clashes occurred in 530-532, 540-545, and 572-590. The last of these confrontations ended on a hopeful note. The youthful Persian Emperor Khusro II fled to Constantinople, seeking the Byzantines' help against rival challengers at home. Khusro was granted troops, and he went on to successfully recapture his throne. All looked set for a new era of peace and cooperation between these two superpowers. However, when Byzantium was rocked by a military coup in 602, Khusro decided that the time was ripe to renew hostilities, and he launched an all-out attack on his erstwhile ally. The onward march of his forces seemed impossible to check. Syria was captured by 610, Palestine by 614, Egypt by 619, and Anatolia as far as the walls of Constantinople itself by 626. Yet the Byzantine emperor Heraclius, who had wrested the imperial throne from its usurper in 610, made a dramatic comeback by marching through the Caucasus and attacking Persia from the north, supported by a large contingent of Turks. This enabled him to strike at the heart of his enemy's empire, advancing on the capital, Seleucia Ctesiphon, sacking royal residences as he went, and putting the defeated and disgraced Khusro to flight. At one point, it had looked as though the Persians were going to steal the whole show. Thus, in the very early 7th century, the head of the Georgian church told his Armenian counterpart, "The King of Kings, Khusro II, is the lord of the Romans as much as of the land of the Arians." But now the tables were turned, and Heraclius was able to dictate terms to a humbled Persia. Khusro's son made peace with Heraclius in 628 and agreed to restore to the Byzantines all of the lands seized by the Persian troops. In 630, Heraclius celebrated the triumph of the Christian world by restoring the relics of the cross of Jesus to Jerusalem, entering the city in great pomp and ceremony, only 16 years after its sack at the hands of the Persians. Again, all looked set for an Irenic future, and the picture looked even rosier for the Byzantines when the general Shahrbaraz, who had presented himself to Heraclius as a slave and whose son had become a Christian, acceded to the Persian throne in April 630 with the aid of Persian and Byzantine troops. It looked as though Persia would become a vassal of Byzantium, and possibly even a Christian one at that. But yet again, these hopes of a lasting peace between the two superpowers were shattered. Shahrbaraz was not of the royal house of Sasan, and despite the endorsement of Heraclius, was murdered by disgruntled Persian nobles. The Persian Empire descended into civil war, leaving its borders, already neglected during its quarter-century-long conflict with Byzantium, woefully exposed. The spread of universalizing monotheism. In the course of this last great war of antiquity, Christianity had become more intimately linked to the fate of the Byzantine Empire. It was the Virgin Mary who was thought to have saved Constantinople in its hour of greatest need, when Persians were baying outside the very walls of the city. Heraclius's campaign against the Persians was a holy war. He was a new David, and he led an army of crusaders who fought for God's cause. This worldview began to take form in the aftermath of the conversion of Constantine the Great to Christianity in AD 312, which at once made it acceptable, even fashionable, to be a Christian. Importantly, this move allied the fledgling Christian church hierarchy with political power. Patriarchs, bishops, and monks could now call on imperial backing to enforce their will. Churches and monasteries gradually replaced pagan temples and theaters. City councillors slowly ceded their power to Christian clergymen. Non-Christians became ever more suspect and liable to persecution. Grand councils determined orthodoxy and harried those who would not conform. In short, the Roman Empire became Christianized. The imperial office itself was remodeled, reflecting the unprecedented situation that its holder now shared the same faith as a rapidly increasing number of his subjects, and so had an interest in determining and defending their common beliefs. This link between religious and political power became ever stronger in the coming centuries, and the Cold War scenario between Byzantium and Persia gave it additional impetus. Being Christian gradually became equated with being pro-Byzantine, and non-Christians were viewed with ever greater suspicion as potential sympathizers with Persia, an accusation frequently leveled at the Jews. In this situation, political conflicts took on a religious coloring. Thus, when the dynasty of Himyar, which ruled Yemen at this time, converted to Judaism in the late 4th century, Byzantium began to suspect it of pro-Persian tendencies. In the early 6th century, the ambitious Christian rulers of Ethiopia sought to extend their sway over Yemen and justified this move by portraying it as a holy war against the Jewish Himyarite dynasty. Their success was celebrated across the Byzantine world as a victory for Christianity. And the efforts of one Himyarite king to suppress pro-Ethiopian elements in his realm in the 520s were written up as an attempt by a Jewish tyrant to persecute innocent Christians who courageously suffered for their faith. Known as the Martyrs of Najran, this story circulated far and wide in many different languages and served as a powerful and emotive piece of propaganda. Christianity is perhaps the most glaring example, but it is a feature of the late antique religions that they were inextricably linked with power, a fact that was hugely significant for the emergence of the Islamic Empire. Zoroastrianism never managed to gain quite the same status in the Persian world, but its clergymen certainly sought imperial backing. One 3rd-century Zoroastrian high priest boasted in an inscription that the King of Kings conferred on me the staff and belt and created for me a higher rank and dignity, and at court and in kingdom after kingdom, place after place, throughout the whole empire he gave me more authority and power in matters of the divine services, and created for me the title Chief Priest of Ahura Mazda, after the name of Ahura Mazda, the deity. Judaism managed to win over the ruling dynasty of Yemen in the 4th to 5th century, as mentioned, and the Khazar elite of the southern Russian steppe in the 8th to 9th century. Buddhism was also very successful at this time, enjoying the patronage of the Chinese emperors and of numerous minor polities in Central Asia, and later, in the 7th century, it was adopted by the ruling dynasty of the Tibetan Empire. The Persian prophet Mani died 274, and his successors made great efforts to win powerful backers for their religion, which we call Manichaeism. It was popular across Central Asia and China, and in 762 it became the creed of the ruling clan of the Uyghur Turks. It was, nevertheless, Christianity that clearly had the greatest reach at this time. It spread eastward in the 5th to 7th century, through Iran and into Central Asia, even reaching China. By the mid-7th century, there were 20 Christian dioceses east of the River Oxus, including Samarkand and Kashgar. One can observe a similar process in Arabia. As early as the mid-4th century, emissaries were being sent from Constantinople to persuade the ruler of the people of Himyar to become Christian and to give up the deceits of heathenism. And this momentum was sustained via Byzantium's Christian ally in the region, Ethiopia. The church in the Persian realm was very dynamic and established offshoots in all the islands and coastlands of East Arabia in this period, and Christian missionaries were active in all the frontier zones of Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, and North Arabia. The tribal folk of these latter regions are portrayed as accepting the new faith as a result of the power of the Christian God, made manifest by the miraculous deeds of various holy men. By their transition from paganism to true belief, the tribesmen were considered to have entered the civilized fold. Those who were formerly called the Wolves of Arabia became members of the spiritual flock of Christ. These tribes became acculturated to the wider Roman world primarily through the influence of Christianity, and they were often encouraged to settle, which further aided the integration process. For example, One celebrated 5th-century ascetic of the Judean desert converted a great number of tribesmen, and they begged to remain near him. He marked out the site of a church for them, with their tents around it, and he assigned them a priest and deacon. In consequence, they became extremely numerous and spread out to form various encampments. By the early 7th century, it is possible to speak of a fledgling Arab Christianity, based in the settlements of Rusafa in northern Syria, Hira, southern Iraq, Najran, northern Yemen, and a number of places in the Roman province of Arabia stretching from Jabia in the north, in modern southwest Syria, to Petra and Kilwa in the south, in modern South Jordan and northwest Saudi Arabia, respectively. Some of these Arab Christians rose to become members of the Byzantine and Persian elite, and we see them hosting ecclesiastical meetings and sponsoring church building. One of them, a certain Sharahil, son of Zallim, left us a fine testimony to this phenomenon in the form of an inscription carved onto the lintel of a chapel for a martyr named John, which had been commissioned by Sharahil in the year 567. He ordered that the text of the inscription be in two languages, Greek, to show that he was an educated member of Byzantine Christian society, and Arabic, to make clear his roots, his local identity, and his pride in his Arabophone culture. The rise of peripheral peoples. We do not know anything about Sharahil outside of his inscription, but we do see a number of his Arabophone contemporaries playing a substantial role in the imperial armies. The superpower rivalry that began in the 3rd century AD meant that both empires were overstretched and had desperate need to swell the ranks of their military. Men who showed that they and their followers were skilled at waging war were welcomed with open arms and could negotiate for high stipends and titles. Furthermore, whereas before, in the glory days of the Roman Empire, barbarians had been separated and distributed across different units and served under an imperial commander, now they entered service as whole groups and under their own leaders. This imperial policy of seeking out strong leaders and giving them subsidies and titles led to the emergence of ever larger and more powerful groupings as chosen leaders competed with one another for power and status. There were, for example, some 15 chiefs of the Goths when they first appeared in the West in the 4th century, but by the 6th century there were just the two major kingdoms of the Visigoths and Ostrogoths, and they wielded enough military muscle to be able to dictate their demands to the Byzantine emperor. The rise of such kingdoms in the peripheral regions of the Byzantine and Persian empires in the 4th to 6th century is characterized by sociologists as secondary state formation. Groups that enjoyed frequent, sustained, and intensive contact with empires begin to establish rudimentary state structures of their own. Thus, in all the border regions around the Byzantine Empire, we see hybrid polities emerging. Romano-Germanic kingdoms in Western Europe, Romano-Moorish kingdoms in North Africa, and Romano-Arab kingdoms on the periphery of the Levant. They retained their own distinctiveness, using their own language among themselves, preserving their own styles of dress, burial rites, and other customs, but they were proud of their ties with the empire. King Masuna of Altava, in modern West Algeria, proclaimed himself King of the Peoples of the Moors and the Romans, and the chiefs of the Arab tribe of Ghassan enthusiastically commissioned Arabic poetry and at the same time vaunted their imperial titles in their inscriptions and their patronage of Christianity. In the old Chinese classification, these were cooked barbarians in that they had been moderated by close and prolonged interaction with the empires and adopted many of their ways. Beyond them lay barbarians who were less cooked and some who were downright raw. They, too, coveted the material riches that empires possessed, but being more distant from centers of settlement, they had less easy access to them. However, if they spotted a weakness in the imperial defenses, they would seek to enrich themselves by extortion, demanding tribute and taxing trade routes. The late 6th and early 7th centuries presented just such an opportunity, and a number of peoples on the margins of empires seized their chance to raid the two empires. The situation was in many ways the same as had bedeviled the western half of the Roman Empire in the 5th and 6th centuries, when various barbarian groups carved out principalities for themselves, and over time created independent kingdoms. The East had seemed immune from such depredation, since its more complex and diverse economy allowed it to pay for better defense and support a bigger army. But Byzantium and Persia's dangerous infatuation with defeating each other in the late 6th and early 7th centuries depleted their resources and left them exposed to attack. The most powerful of these new peoples were the Turks. They had been one faction among many within a loose tribal coalition on China's northern frontier, but their Kagan, chief, Bumin, with his brother Ishtemi, made a bid for power in 552 and established themselves as the new masters of this region, probably aided by the fact that China was particularly weak and disunited at this time. Subsequently, they expanded westward, vanquishing in the 560s the Hephthalite White Hun Confederation that had dominated Central Asia for the previous century. These Turks are unusual among steppe powers in that they have left us a number of inscriptions in Sogdian and Old Turkish which recount their exploits and ideas, including this reminiscence of an 8th century ruler concerning the founding of his realm. When the blue sky above and the dark earth below were fashioned, human beings were created between the two. My ancestors, the Kagans Bumin and Ishtemi, rose above the sons of men. Having become the masters of the Turk people, they established and ruled its empire and fixed the law of the country. Many were their enemies in the four corners of the world, but leading campaigns against them, they subjugated and pacified them, making them bow their heads and bend their knees. They pushed eastward to the forest of Kardir Khan and westward to the Iron Gate. Thus far did the realm of the Turks reach. They were wise Kagans, they were valiant Kagans, all their officers were wise and valiant. All their nobles as well as common people were just. This was why they were able to rule an empire so great, and why, governing the empire, they could uphold the law. By 583, the empire had split into eastern and western portions. The former, in Mongolia, primarily contended with China, engaging it in major confrontations in the late 6th and early 7th centuries. The western Turks, occupying the area from the Black Sea to Lake Issyk-Kul, in modern Kyrgyzstan, sought to challenge Persia, but two of the latter's commanders of the eastern marches defeated them in a series of battles in the late 580s and mid-610s. Instead, the Turks sent out feelers to Byzantium, whose emperors were happy to receive such powerful aid against their arch-enemy and to buy the silk and other luxury goods from China that they were trading. Byzantine courtiers perhaps smiled when envoys from the Kagan referred to him as Great Lord of the Seven Races, Master of the Seven Climes, and yet it was only with the aid of the Turks that Heraclius was able to defeat the Persians in 627. In the mid-6th century, another barbarian group, the Avars, began their rise to prominence. They seem to have been traveling westward from Central Asia, pushed along by the advance of the newly created Turk polity. They reached northern Caucasia in the winter of 557 and sent envoys to Constantinople, whose inhabitants marveled at their long, plaited hair. The Byzantine emperor agreed to pay them a subsidy and directed them to attack various unruly elements in the Balkans. Gradually, the Avars subjugated all the peoples of that region, including the Bulgars and Slavs, and raided as far afield as the river Elbe, coming into confrontation with the Franks. But this military might was soon turned against Byzantium, and in 582 they conquered the strategic town of Sirmium, modern Sremska Mitrovica in Serbia. Clashes continued for many years, with the Avars most often having the upper hand, and they culminated in full-scale attacks on Constantinople itself in 619 and 626. The latter assault was particularly terrifying for the capital's residents, since it coincided with a simultaneous attack on the city by the Persians. The Byzantine navy was, however, able to stop all communication between the two enemy forces across the Bosphorus, and harried the small ships of the Slav contingent. Lack of supplies and the immensity of Constantinople's encompassing walls gave rise to discontents, and the siege was called off. The Avars never quite recovered their prestige, and the Slavs and Bulgars soon broke away to found their own polities. The Avars were also constrained to the east by yet another emerging political player, the Khazars, who established themselves in the lower Volga region sometime between the 630s and 650s. They seem to have begun as a group within the Turk Confederation, which was at that time coming under severe pressure from the recently established Tang dynasty in China. The Khazars' territory stretched from modern Ukraine to western Kazakhstan, and their rule lasted some three centuries, circa 650 to 969, making them a particularly long-lived example of a steppe empire. The reason for their longevity was their evolution into a highly successful trans-Eurasian trade hub, connecting the northern forest zones with the Byzantine and Islamic empires. Moreover, the regime reinforced its own distinctiveness and independence by converting to Judaism in the 8th to 9th century. The Khazars were, in short, a formidable power, and presented the Arabs with a serious challenge on their northern flank, especially in the period 708 to 737, when the two sides came together as equals and battled each other for supremacy of Caucasia. In some ways, the rise of these peripheral peoples is a success story. By close and constant interaction with the empires, they had learned to organize themselves in a more sophisticated way, so that they were now capable of orchestrating major coordinated military action. They were not homogeneous entities, but coalitions of numerous groups of different origins and ethnicities, atop of which often sat a presiding dynasty. However, the resources that they obtained by extortion and pillage allowed them to buy loyalty, to unite fragmentary and diverse groups into more cohesive wholes, to articulate a sense of identity, and to promote their own culture. For the empires, there was a danger in this development in that some of these peoples became powerful enough to challenge them. The Persian Emperor Peroz, 457 to 484, made use of the Hephthalites of Central Asia to fight his younger brother, who had usurped the throne, but he was later to die at their hands when the relationship turned sour. A century later, the Persians allied with the newly ascendant power in Central Asia, the Turks, to destroy the Hephthalite kingdom, but later the Turks struck a deal with Byzantium and reinforced the Emperor Heraclius with enough troops to defeat Khusro II. The Avars only appeared on the scene in the mid-6th century, but they were soon able to cause the Byzantines a major headache, and their surprise attacks on Constantinople almost brought about the demise of the empire. Yet these peoples, the Arabs included, did not attack an empire in order to destroy it, despite what imperial citizens claimed. Rather, they sought to appropriate some of its wealth for themselves, or even to make themselves its new masters. Arabia and the Arabs. The most successful of the peripheral peoples were the Arabs, whose conquests are the subject of this book. They are very difficult to write about because the term Arab has, as one would expect, meant different things to different people at different times, since it was first introduced into the historical record almost 3 millennia ago. A recent academic study into the nature of pre-Islamic Arabs concluded that they were nomadic, camel-rearing, religiously fanatical desert warriors, essentially lumping together all the stereotypes about them held by settled peoples, on whose writings the author had relied for his data. These stereotypes have endured into our age, reinforced by films such as Lawrence of Arabia, and so it is immensely difficult to persuade even educated people that Arabs were not all nomadic desert dwellers, and indeed that some were sedentary and even members of the imperial elite. The idea of Arabia as a harsh, unchanging desert world populated only by heroic, martial Bedouin has a romantic fascination for Western culture, and for many Middle Eastern societies too, which have regarded the Arabian deserts and their denizens as the source from whence they all hailed. In reality, Arabia has harbored a number of very different peoples, some of which did not define themselves as Arabs, and some of which possessed advanced and complex cultures. It was also not as remote as is generally assumed, but was heavily exposed to the influences and machinations of empires and enjoyed mercantile contacts with other polities, such as Ethiopia and India. To the Assyrians and the Israelites, the Arabs were the inhabitants of the Syrian desert, which lay between Iraq and Palestine, and of the vast, empty lands to the south, that is, the Arabian Peninsula. These arid regions therefore became known as the Land of the Arabs, or, more popularly, Arabia. Subsequently, by an understandable piece of circular reasoning, all who lived in the area known as Arabia were frequently referred to by outsiders as Arabs, and sometimes Arabians. Greek speakers used both Arabis and Arabioi. For a long time, the label was probably of only loose significance to those to whom it was applied, who used more specific words to identify themselves, such as the name of their tribe or region, but two developments gave it greater substance. The first was the rise of the Nabataeans, who were identified as Arabs, spoke an Arabic dialect, and established a kingdom in the 2nd century BC that encompassed the whole territory from the Euphrates to the Red Sea. The second was the annexation by the Romans of this realm in AD 105. Elements of the old kingdom blended with imperial traditions to create a distinctive culture in this new province of Arabia, many of whose inhabitants now began to call themselves Arabs and were referred to as such by outsiders. The geographical extent of this province pretty much overlapped with the former Nabataean kingdom, equating to modern southern Syria, all of Jordan, southern Palestine, Israel, and northwest Saudi Arabia. It had no fixed southern and eastern borders. The land there was dry and barren, bar scattered oases, and so was of little interest to the Romans. Yet some of the inhabitants of these desert territories were proud to consider themselves part of the empire. A military unit from the tribe of Thamud, for example, erected a temple in honor of Marcus Aurelius, 161 to 180, in their hometown, not so far north of Muhammad's Medina. Over the centuries, the province came to generate a strong sense of identity among its inhabitants, even though they were quite diverse in other respects. A bird augurer named Rufinus, temporarily resident on the island of Thasos in the 3rd century AD, calls himself an Arab because, as he emphasizes in an epitaph for his son, he was a native of Qanawat in the north of Roman Arabia. A funerary inscription concerning two soldiers, which dates to 522 and was found in the Jordan Valley, stresses that they hailed from the lands of the people of the Arabs. And a couple of 6th century monks from a monastery near Jericho are described as Arabs on their tombstones. Some may have been linked by a common language, Arabic, but this was a polyglot land, and in the end it was principally an attachment to their province that bound them. These Arabs were settled folk, citizens of the Roman, Byzantine Empire, but there were also Arabs who lived as nomadic pastoralists, refusing to be subject to taxes and the dictates of bureaucrats. Settled people would always draw a clear distinction between themselves and these nomadic Arabs, regarding the latter as devoid of civilized values. Yet despite their apparent marginality, it is the nomadic Arabs who feature more prominently in late antique sources, and this is for two main reasons. In the first place, they were converting to Christianity. In this, they were influenced by the early Christian ascetic movement, which saw the arid lands on the periphery of the Byzantine and Persian empires populated by hermits and monastic communities. A whole new genre of literature arose that celebrated the more heroic representatives of this movement and their devout exploits. In texts of this genre, the indigenous inhabitants of the desert lands loom large, usually designated as Saracens or Taye, the terms used by Byzantine and Persian citizens for the nomadic Arabs. Sometimes they are portrayed as predatory creatures whose attacks are foiled by the anchorites' appeal to God, and at other times they are characterized as impure beings whose lives are then enlightened by the piety of a holy man. Numerous were their superstitions, and they were the most ignorant of all the peoples of the earth until the moment when the light of Christ came to them. A good example of such a desert missionary is Ahudeme, who, according to his acolyte, assiduously visited all the camps of the nomads in northern Mesopotamia, instructing them in the faith and preaching to them the word of God. He inaugurated churches, which he cleverly named after tribal chiefs, who would therefore feel encouraged to maintain them, and thus he inclined the hearts of the Arabs to the love of God. In the second place, the nomadic Arabs were serving in the armies of Byzantium and Persia in increasing numbers. The term nomad unit and the names of commanders of such units appear in inscriptions at this time, and a document from around the year 400 lists Saracen cavalry regiments at locations in Egypt, Phoenicia, and Palestine. Given the benefits that association with the empires could bring, especially titles and stipends, many chiefs actively sought to win the recognition of the authorities. An early example of such a figure is Imru al-Qais ibn Amr, whose exploits are celebrated in an epitaph inscribed on the lintel of his tomb, which lies in the basalt desert southeast of Damascus and is dated to AD 328. It records how he asserted his authority, on behalf of Rome, over various tribes as far south as Najran, on the northern edges of Yemen. And over the following 3 centuries, there were many who strove to emulate him, flexing their muscles and making ever grander demands. Much feared was Queen Mawia, flourished 370s, who ravaged the eastern provinces when she did not receive her usual payments, but who showed herself to be fully at home within the Byzantine Empire, renewing the alliance once her requests were granted, and even giving her daughter in marriage to a high-ranking member of the imperial army. Then there was Abacarib, flourished 530s, who was appointed by the emperor Justinian the Great to maintain order among the pastoralist tribes in Palestine and to halt the incursions of tribes from outside the province. He achieved great success in this position, for both to the barbarians over whom he ruled and no less to the enemy, Abu-Kharib always seemed a man to be feared and an exceptionally energetic fellow. He also features in a contemporary Syriac manuscript from the Palmyra region, where he is addressed as king by the copyist, and in a Greek papyrus from Petra, where he acts as an arbiter in a property dispute between two residents of the city. It would seem, then, that these Arab leaders were becoming increasingly involved in the life of the province to which they were assigned by the imperial authorities, acting as local power brokers in the lives of the settled communities on the margins of the empires. By the time of Abu-Kharib, we can speak of Romano-Arab and Perso-Arab polities. A number of the dynasties lasted 3, 4, or more generations, suggesting that they possessed sufficient political power to ensure succession from one generation to another and to instill allegiance. They had bases of varying degrees of permanence where they could store wealth, receive embassies, conduct a rudimentary administration, and hold court. All had organizational structures for relaying commands, and all could muster substantial military manpower, their key attraction to their imperial masters. In addition, all had at least modest revenues, deriving from imperial payments, booty, and extraction of tribute from weaker tribes. This they used to win loyalty and to extend patronage, which is manifested to us in building inscriptions and collections of poetry. The latter, composed in Arabic, praised patrons and scorned enemies, and in general presented an idealized picture of Bedouin life. Meals shared with guests around the fire, amorous liaisons with the women of neighboring camps, fast camel rides across the desert, battles won and lost, honor defended, and always the heroic struggle against fate, time, and the elements. The homogeneity of the themes presented and the norms espoused clearly reflected and reinforced a body of shared values and experiences. This poetry contributed to the formation of a broad Arab identity, and the hybrid Arab polities that sponsored it paved the way for the coming Arab empire by assimilating customs and practices of both the settled and the nomadic worlds. The rise to prominence of these dynasties was very much a consequence of the stepping up of hostilities between Byzantium and Persia, which made both of them court those who could provide military assistance. As the conflict between these two empires intensified, greater power was granted to their favored tribal allies. This was undertaken first by the Persian emperor Kawad, 488 to 531, who appointed the fearless Mundhir ibn Nu'man, 504 to 554, a chief of the tribe of Lacham, based in the southwest Iraqi settlement of Hira, as sole overlord of the tribes in his lands. To counter this man, who for half a century forced the Roman state to bend its knee, the various clans loyal to the Byzantines were brought together under Harith ibn Jabala, 529 to 569, a chief of the tribe of Ghassan, now granted the title of king by the emperor himself, a thing which had never been done by the Byzantines before. The military power at the disposal of Harith was demonstrated later in this century when his son was exiled by the Emperor Maurice, 582 to 602. This impelled his men to go on a rampage in Syria and Arabia, which so terrified the inhabitants of the countryside, claimed one contemporary, perhaps with some exaggeration, that they fled for refuge to the cities and did not dare appear outside. Byzantine and Persian citizens employed the terms Saracen and Taye to designate the nomads of Arabia and the imperial borderlands, whereas they used the term Arab to refer to the settled inhabitants of the provinces of Arabia. It is important to bear in mind, however, that the various tribes on the edges of the empires did not call themselves Saracens or Taye. Indeed, we know that they felt some degree of affinity with the settled Arabs. For example, the aforementioned Imr al-Qais, whom the Romans called a Saracen, styled himself king of all the Arabs, al-Arab, seemingly referring to the provinces of Roman and Persian Arabia and their inhabitants. And a poet who was born in the lifetime of Muhammad sang, "You call us nomads, but our name is the Arabs." Language was almost certainly a crucial ingredient in this shared identity. Sharahil ibn Zalim and the Prophet Muhammad were contemporaries, and to both of them it was evidently important to compose in their native tongue. Sharahil made a point of having the dedication of the martyrium that he had paid for written in Arabic as well as Greek, and he is the first person we know of who did this. Muhammad stressed that the revelation he brought from God was in the Arab tongue, Lisan Arabi, and that he was the first prophet to employ it. The revelation, he emphasized, could have been conveyed in a foreign, Ajami, tongue, one more conventionally used for such discourse.